KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks for tuning in today to Hearsay Culture. Today we continue our irregular series on patent law and discussing the world of patents. And today I'm very pleased to have on Professor Timothy Holbrook from Chicago Kent School of Law. Tim writes in a variety of areas. We're going to focus today on his scholarship with regard to patents, and he's written a number of recent articles in the world of patent law that I think listeners will find illuminating, and indeed touch on some perhaps somewhat lesser discussed but very important aspects of the patent maze that currently exists. By way of very brief background before I introduce the topic, Professor Holbrook is an associate professor of law with tenure and the associate director of the program in intellectual property law at Chicago Kent's College of Law. He graduated from North Carolina State University with a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering with a Life Sciences concentration. And oftentimes when we chat with patent people, as it were, or people that focus in patent areas, they often have an engineering and science background, although I emphasize to my students that that is not, in my view, a prerequisite to do all forms of patent, but certainly some of it, it's quite helpful. He also received his JD from Yale Law School. After law school, he clerked for the Honorable Glenn L. Archer, Jr. of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which listeners of the show will know that that circuit handles patent appeals. Following his clerkship, he worked in Budapest, Hungary, with the Hungarian patent firm Danubia. And prior to joining the Chicago Kent faculty in 2000, he was an associate in Washington, D.C., with the law firm of Wiley, Ryan, and Fielding, where he focused on patent and appellate litigation. As I mentioned, he's written in a wide variety of areas with regard to patent, including a few that we're going to discuss today. One article that he has that is being published by William & Mary Law Review is entitled Extraterritoriality in U.S. patent law. And that's a topic which we hear about discussed in roundabout ways in various venues, but the article focuses directly on the issues of enforcement of U.S. patents overseas and how the world, as it were, handles U.S. patent litigation. Are there ways to harmonize law across national boundaries that would perhaps make the patent system more efficient? Are there ways to handle the situation in such a way that hopefully we would have a patent system which is less prone to variables and other different types of problems that often exist when you deal with patent litigation or enforcement of patents? So we're going to be discussing that article, Extraterritoriality in U.S. Patent Law. Tim has also written in another fascinating area of the patenting of human genes, and that's something we're going to discuss as well. But hopefully in this discussion, I think we'll be able to probe a topic in patent law or a few that we haven't discussed much on Hearsay Culture. Early on in the show's history, over a year ago now, Jamie King, who's now a professor at UC Hastings, came on to discuss biotechnology, and we've also discussed biotechnology to some degree with Mark Lemley and a few other guests over the history of Hearsay Culture. But we're going to dive very deeply into these issues of cross-border patent litigation and patent enforcement, as well as take a look at the issues of human genes and patenting. So with that introduction, done my job properly, and hopefully the phone's still working, Tim, are you there?
I am here. Thank you very much, Dave. It's great to be here.
Thank you for being on the show today and for taking the time. Tim, why don't we start off, as I do with most of my guests, for those that aren't familiar with you and your background, I've given a bit of introduction, so perhaps if there's anything you want to add to your background, feel free, but focus on how you got into or why you're interested in both doing patents in practice as well as writing on issues of patent law.
Yeah, I tend to think of myself as sort of the accidental professor, that when I was younger in high school, I was a debater. I think a lot of attorneys start off their life sort of as debaters. But my father was an engineer, and I had an interest in science and math, but I also had this interest in law. So before going to college, I talked to people, said, you know, if I do engineering, does that mean I can't be a lawyer? And everyone looked at me and said, are you nuts? Being an engineer is a great pre-law degree. It'll be very helpful. So I did engineering thinking, well, if I like it, then I'll go to grad school in it. If I don't, then I can go to law school. And if I just burn out completely from being in school, I can actually get a job. So that's how I landed as an engineer. I decided to go to law school, but I actually went to law school to save the environment. I was a chemical engineer and hoped to do in wetlands protection. All my essays for law school applications were based on environmental law. And so I sort of stumbled upon patent law accidentally. My dad had patents as an engineer, so I knew about them. But really, my first year of law school, a friend of mine showed me an article in a newspaper about a patent law firm in Charlotte, North Carolina, which is actually where your law school now is.
Yep.
And I needed a job for the summer. So I applied, got the job, and I said, this patent stuff is pretty interesting. You know, it involves economics in terms of why we have patents. It involves technology, so I could sort of entertain myself and maintain my curiosity about technology. And it's law. And so I started doing patents over the summers because at that time, Yale Law School really had one class on intellectual property. That was it. And then I decided to clerk, and at the Federal Circuit, you know, it is basically the patent court in the U.S., I thought, well, this will give me an introduction to patent law. If I like it, I'll have a skill. If I don't, you know, it's still a clerkship. I can still go on and do other things if I don't want to do patent law. So I sort of inadvertently stumbled upon it and absolutely fell in love with it. I mean, I sometimes refer to it as dork law, but I love it. It's economics, it's science, it's law, it's everything, and it's obviously an important issue in an information-based economy like we have in the United States.
Your background is one that, as I mentioned in the introduction, is somewhat typical, if not fairly typical, with regard to people that actually go into practicing patent law. And I thought I might get your reaction to my comment that it isn't a necessary prerequisite in all areas of patent litigation or patent enforcement to have that kind of background. What's your reaction to that piece of advice?
I absolutely agree. And the only situation where it is an absolute prerequisite is if you want to be admitted to the patent bar. If you want to file patent applications and practice before the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, yes, you have to have a technical background. But to do patent litigation, you just need to be a lawyer. Now, that being said, it's not officially a prerequisite. It's easier to get into that field if you have the technical background. But I tell my non-technical students, if you want to do this kind of work, you go to a general practice firm because they are more likely to hire someone with a non-technical background, and you volunteer. Right? Your first assignment might be a discovery dispute that surrounds a patent case, but that has nothing in it that really requires a technical degree. If the partners and senior associates like your work, they'll go back to you. When I was at Wiley Ryan and Fielding, they're now Wiley Ryan, this happened all the time. We wanted good lawyers. If you had a technical background, it was great plus, but, you know, we would recruit non-technical lawyers to help us out with cases, and people can develop a specialty that way. So I always emphasize to my students that without a technical background, if you want to do patent law, you can do it. You have to be entrepreneurial about it, and it'll be a little bit tougher row to hoe, but you can absolutely have that kind of practice.
Yeah, it comports with the advice that similarly I give to my students with my background in entertainment litigation. And they ask me how to be an entertainment litigator, and I tell them that the firm that I spent the majority of private practice in at Prior Cashman in New York, it was the same theory. They wanted good lawyers. If you're interested in entertainment law, that was helpful. But really what they wanted were people that wanted to be litigators. And so long as you wanted to be a litigator, you'd have the opportunity to do this kind of work. So it's interesting how some of these fields mesh that way. Let's dive in, and as I mentioned in the introduction, there have been prior guests on to have discussed patents, and so we don't have to spend as much time on patent background. But again, for listeners that may be tuning in for the first time or haven't heard those previous shows, how about and this is a wonderfully unfair question, how about a 2 or 3 minute overview of the very basic tip, not even tip of the iceberg, of what a patent is?
A patent patent is really a grant by the federal government of a right to exclude other people from doing what you created. And we give this property right, we give this right to exclude if you've created something that is new, that's not a trivial improvement over the state of the art. It's got to be something that we view significant, and it has to satisfy some other requirements. It has to be useful, and that means it can't, you know, any mousetrap could serve as a paperweight. But if it doesn't actually work for its purpose, then it's not really useful. And so the patents are granted by the government to basically give you this right to exclude. The idea being, in part, this encourages you to invent in the first place, right? If I can invent it, I get this right to exclude others. That gives me some advantage on the market if I try and sell it. And that way, hopefully, I can recoup any sunk costs that I had in developing the technology. So that's... We're very basic primer on patent law, but importantly, it's a grant of a right to exclude from the government, and particularly the U.S. government. And that dovetails into what we'll be talking about, I think, that these are grants from national governments, and other governments grant patents as well, but they are specific to a given country. So if I get a patent in the United States, that has no bearing technically on whether or not I can get a patent in Canada or in Europe, right? It's only from the U.S. federal government. I get rights within the United States. And so it's very specific to the individual country.
The and it's something that we will be chatting about as well later in the show, discussing this the hot debate going on right now with regard to software business method patents. But just two more very quick background questions, and you kind of touched on that answer. But when we talk about patentable subject matter, again, a hot area, but in general terms, what is patentable?
What is patentable? Technically, it's supposed to be compositions of matter, processes. I mean, you typically think of patents involving a new chemical compound like pharmaceuticals or a new material or an industrial process. Over the last 20 years, what has been eligible for patent protection has definitely expanded. As we may discuss later, you get patents on purified human genes. There's patents out there on methods of arbitrating, although those are questionable in some current litigation. Methods of avoiding taxes, right? So what is eligible for patent protection, the subject matter, has expanded considerably in the last 20 years. So now you can get, it used to be that software is protected primarily by copyright. Now you can patent software. There's people that have, you know, patented methods of swinging on a swing. Now these are examples of some what people would say are bad patents, patents that should not have issued.
Right.
But there's very little that seems to be ineligible for patent protection at this time. And there seem to be more and more patent rights given to things that are intangible. You tend to think of as technology and inventions in the past being about mechanical devices or chemical processes. Now we're talking about things that are a little more intangible, like, you know, how do you do an arbitration? There was a case that was decided today talking about how do you place shoes in a store to facilitate consumers doing their own shopping.
And just for the benefit of the listeners, we're recording a show on August 19th. But they'll be hearing the show August 20th, so
okay.
It'll be pretty well timed. The last very brief background, which gets us into your article on extraterritoriality. When we talk about the right to exclude, what exactly does that mean with regard to the patent holder, and then conversely for someone that wants to build upon a particular patent?
For the patent holder, it means that they can stop anybody else from practicing their particular invention, although the patent doesn't necessarily give them the right to use their own invention. Right? So if I create something that is in a heavily regulated industry, a new drug, right? The fact that I have the patent on it doesn't mean that I can run out and sell the drug. I still have to make sure it doesn't kill people.
Right.
But what it does give me is the right to stop other people from then pursuing that drug, trying to sell it and manufacture it. So it's only about the right to exclude others. Part of the idea of the patent system is that the patent does disclose your invention. People can then read what you've created and hopefully build upon it. The reality is that often, even though those improvements can be separately patentable, so if I build the better mousetrap based off of your original mousetrap, I can get a separate patent for it. But if I still infringe the original patent, I can't practice my own invention, right? So it is this odd system that, yes, you can build upon what somebody else did, but you may not be able to practice that improvement because you're still infringing the original patent. That's what would be called a blocking patent situation.
Mm-hmm. Let's dive into your article,
okay.
Extraterritoriality and U.S. patent law. So, you mentioned it earlier. The focus of the article, very broadly, is the enforcement of patents issued by the U.S. government outside of the U.S. What do you mean, or is there a deeper definition of extraterritoriality than that very basic one that I just posited?
Well, there's, as we're lawyers, right? So any term, there's always fights over what you mean by the definition. And when I talk extraterritoriality, I'm talking about basically what you said, where you're using the U.S. patent to somehow regulate activities occurring outside of the United States. Now, typically under the U.S. patent laws, there has to be some nexus to the United States, some step, some act, something within the United States, but then there might be other acts. The actual sales of the invention might be outside the United States, but the ultimate idea is I'm using a U.S. patent to try and control or influence behaviors and activities that are occurring outside of the United States.
Mm-hmm. And with regard to those kinds of activities, are they the kind of activities that one might think of, just literally someone trying to steal your patent, use it in a way that's unauthorized, or are there specific kind of instances that come up more often in cross-border disputes involving patents?
I think that's a pretty strong mix of both, and I think that there are examples of people trying to take inventions and use them outside the United States to avoid the U.S. patent system. And then there are also increasingly these trans-border situations, in large part because so much of what we patent now are, you know, systems that you know, the Internet itself, it goes all over the world. So if you have an invention based on the Internet, some acts may be in the U.S., some may be outside. So I think it's a mix of both, and I think both are on the rise. I really think these issues of territorial lines for patents are going to become increasingly complex because it's a global marketplace, right? You have actors, multinational corporations who are selling things all over the globe, yet they have these patents that are still supposed to be limited to national borders. When you have a lot of manufacturing occurring in places like China or India, and then they're being imported into the United States, right, there's lots of concerns about, well, what's really going on here? Are they trying to end run the patents? And so I think it's a mix of both. But I think both circumstances where you have some system that straddles national borders, or you have someone trying to steal, in essence, the invention and use it outside the United States, I think both of those circumstances are of becoming increasingly important, and those acts are increasingly occurring.
We hear, you know, the parallel that I think comes up, or that listeners who don't follow these issues closely might think of, is your classic piracy issue in copyright. And there has been a fair amount of press written on the issues of just DVDs being ripped off and burned in places like China and others, and efforts by both the U.S. government as well as the U.S. entertainment industry to attempt to get foreign governments to enforce their copyright based upon U.S. law. Do we find similar kinds of battles or similar kinds of issues occurring on the patent level to the same degree of impact on particular industries? And if so, what industries are really being hit by this?
I think we see very, very similar issues. It's very strong in particular industries. I think the most famous, and I think the listeners will probably be aware of this, are pharmaceutical companies, particularly for countries that are suffering from the AIDS epidemic, who want to make generic copies or illicit copies of drugs, and they can't because of the patent holder. So it's a little bit different, that it's not quite piracy in the sense that we think of in copyright. But I think pharmaceuticals, this issue of enforcing patent rights is very, very important. I think that as software is now patent eligible, absolutely that industry is impacted. The big difference, and I think between copyright and patent, and why this creates a little bit tougher challenge for patent law, is that under international law, If I make something, I have a copyright for it basically everywhere, right? So if I create a musical work in the United States, technically under international law, I should have a copyright in China, even though the copyrights are nationally based. Patents, you don't get automatic patent protection for just creating something. You have to apply for it. You have to ask the government to give you the right. And so that can be expensive, right? If I'm trying to protect my product globally, I have to ask for patent protection in every country. And if I don't ask, then technically there's no patent. And it is okay to practice my invention in a given country if I did not ask for protection. And so whereas copyright is sort of, right, the default is you have a copyright. In patent, the default is you don't have a patent. Mm-hmm. You got to ask for it. So it does make it tougher for patent holders to enforce their rights on a national level because they have to anticipate, well, what markets am I going to enter into? Where do I want to assert protection? And if you get it wrong, you're likely not going to be able to get patent protection after the fact because in that country, your invention is no longer new, right? Mm-hmm. It's been known around the world. So it requires quite a bit more forethought for companies to anticipate, well, what markets do we hope to exploit? Where do we think we'll need patent protection before the market may actually develop?
The intersection, and perhaps this stretches a little bit, but I'm curious, and it got me thinking as you were talking about this, there, of course, is an overlap to some degree with trade secrecy law, and trade secrecy law being a beast, at least in the United States, of state law, has quite a wide variety of how it's applied and how it's defined within the states, but it's also a doctrine that's recognized in some countries and not others. Mm-hmm. With regard to the potential that one's U.S. patent would not be enforceable or as strong in another country, is there an incentive, in your view, for businesses to resort to trade secrets as a way to protect their inventions? In other words, literally running the risk, at least under U.S. law, that the trade secret could be reverse engineered, but ultimately keeping it as a secret and in that way preventing some of the risks that you're describing could occur if a patent isn't enforced.
I think that would be the case. Now, obviously, they're not going to go for patent protection in one country and trade secrecy protection in another, unless there's something different, because the patent in the United States is published and anybody in the world can find it. So you'd immediately eliminate your trade secret. So it would be either we're going to pursue all patent protection or all trade secret protection. But for, you know, inventions that are not easily reverse engineered, right? If it's something that is really tough to figure out what you did, then yeah, I think if you're going to be operating in markets that value and protect trade secrets, that would be a strong option for you. And, you know, trade secrets can last indefinitely, right? Patent protection is only for 20 years from the day that you file your application, so it's a finite term. So I think there are advantages to trade secrets, but you know, if you do get a patent in one country, you sort of destroy globally your trade secret rights because in essence you've put it out into the public. Mm-hmm. So it becomes an either or. And once you opt for patent, then you've got to figure out, well, what patchwork of patent protection do we want?
You discuss in the article at length some potential approaches to dealing with these issues, and one that you describe as the effects-based approach. What are the approaches that you've considered that you ultimately view as inadequate or insufficient to deal with these problems?
Well, I think there's sort of two extreme approaches. One that you mentioned are these effects-based approaches, and the idea is that if these activities outside of the United States affect the United States in some way, like they impact the market for the patented invention, then it is appropriate to use the U.S. patent against those activities. So now, for example, you know, so someone selling the drug at a lower price in Brazil, for example, we could argue, well, that has an impact on the U.S. market price for various reasons, gray markets. Sometimes people, when trying to negotiate prices in pharmaceuticals, will say, hey, look, you're charging less in this country, so that could create downward pressure on the price in the United States. So that would be a broad effect, right? If there's any impact on the United States market, we should use the U.S. patent to protect the interest of the patent holder. I think that's pretty broad. That would be basically saying you can use the U.S. patent to try and regulate activities in Brazil simply because it might impact our price. Brazil may not like that, right? They have their own policies governing their patent system. Patents are creatures of national law. They may not be happy that the United States is stepping in and saying, look, all these activities in Brazil are now causing consequences in the United States. And that's one reason that there's concern about using U.S. patents extraterritorially, that you don't want to create these conflicts between two sovereign countries where their policies may differ. You know, patents are an arm of public policy like anything else, and so there may be different policy choices in other countries. So the fear with a broad extraterritorial protection, this effects-type approach, is that you're really ignoring the interests of the foreign country. Mm-hmm. You saw this in the BlackBerry litigation, which, sort of a disclaimer, my law firm represented the patent owner in the BlackBerry case. I had left the firm well before they did, before they took the case on, much to my dismay financially in some regards, but neither here nor there. Part of the BlackBerry system is actually in Canada. And so when the courts in the U.S. said, hey, there's infringement of the U.S. patent, the Canadian government was saying, excuse us, right, part of the system's in Canada. We have an interest in this system, and you're ignoring our interest. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the concern with that broad approach. The other approach is to be really strict about it and say, hey, look, if anything happens outside of the United States, then there's no infringement of the U.S. patent. Right, deal with it some other way. Right, so in the BlackBerry case, they could have easily said, look, part of the system's in Canada. That's outside the United States. A U.S. patent cannot reach that activity. No liability. We're done. Mm-hmm. Right, so the benefit of the strict approach is that it's pretty clear. You know, outside the United States, no liability, and it clearly would avoid a potential conflict with Canadian law. You know, in some areas, particularly software patent, you know, a lot of countries don't protect software inventions, so you avoid that kind of conflict. The downside is it makes it pretty easy to avoid the patent, not only in the United States, but potentially elsewhere. Fine, I'll stick a remote sensor in some random country where you don't have patent protection, and boom, mm-hmm. I've avoided the patent. Right, so that strict formal rule might make it easy to evade the patent. And it's also overly deferential to these potential conflicts of law, right? Suppose mm-hmm. there is no difference between Canadian patent law and United States patent law. Why are we so concerned then about this potential conflict if there isn't one? You know, mm-hmm. if there isn't one, why not go ahead and let there be liability? We're not going to have this difficulty between the two countries. So I think it's a little bit too harsh of a response, and it definitely ignores the nature of the marketplace that we now exist with the global market.
We're talking with Tim Holbrook, a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law here on Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM. We're going to take a very quick break here, and that break is not a break for me, but certainly a break for my guests. And as always, now's the time where I ask you for money. I ask you to reach into your pocket or perhaps write something, or even more specifically, use the wonderful world of e-commerce to make a donation to KZSU-FM. KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that depends on donations from listeners like you in order to keep its diverse programming going. And I emphasize for those of you listening by way of podcasts and not directly live on KZSU, KZSU is the home of Hearsay Culture, and so that donation does help the show. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless of what you do, I do hope you continue to listen to Hearsay Culture as well as to KZSU. So, Tim, we're back, and you were talking there right before that brief break about some of the proposed solutions, and I think, you know, both of them tie into this, you know, basic reticence that naturally you would expect countries would have in enforcing another country's laws. And we see these issues come up again and again, not just in copyright, but we've seen it fairly well documented in the world of online gaming and the U.S. efforts to make its views by way of criminal law regarding the legality of online gaming applicable to companies operating or at least having their headquarters in foreign countries but doing business here. In that realm, and similarly, you propose a solution to this issue that you call the conflicts-based approach. What is that approach exactly?
Well, my thought is the main concern with using a U.S. patent and applying it to activities outside the United States is this concern of creating some sort of conflict with foreign law, that you're interfering with the ability of a sovereign to act and justify its own policies. Well, both approaches, the effects base, ignores that problem. The territorial approach just assumes that, well, if there's even the chance of a conflict, we don't do it. We just don't apply the law. My thought is, well, why not explore those differences? We can actually have the parties, if you want your patent to apply extraterritorially, which is an exceptional request, then you need to demonstrate that the countries implicated by your lawsuit there won't be a conflict with that country's laws. And if everything is fine, then we'll go ahead and apply the U.S. patents extraterritorially. But if there's going to be some sort of conflict, then we won't do it. You're going to have to find some other method to do it. And that way, you actually have an express consideration of foreign law. I think that's helpful in terms of, you could call this sort of soft harmonization, right? If you have the courts considering foreign law, that may actually help inform U.S. law better. Mm-hmm. And you may actually get better ideas for how to improve U.S. patent law by doing that. But that way, we actually explore the issues and hopefully can try and accommodate these potential differences in policy without simply just assuming that it's a reason to completely not apply the U.S. patent territorially, or the other extreme, to completely ignore the foreign country's interests in the activity.
The conflicts themselves manifest themselves in a variety of ways, as we chatted about earlier, and it leads to a question which I'm sure is one that you deal with in the article, and that no doubtly people who have given you feedback on the article have asked, which is ultimately the workability of the solution. So how is that solution workable?
I think it's workable for on a number of levels. With respect to patent law, there is a fair amount of diversity among countries about patent law, but we do have a fairly decent level of harmonization. In other words, that the countries that have joined the World Trade Organization have agreed that their patent laws will contain certain elements to it. And so there's a certain level of agreement about, well, what is eligible for patent protection. So I think you've got this at least prima facie level of harmonization that already exists. So that makes it a little bit more workable. Second, to me, the country, if a patentee really wants to enforce their patent, and it has these transnational implications, they better be willing to explain that to a court, right? And so we're not talking about, I think in terms of the information about the countries, you've got a very strong incentive for the patent owner and for the accused infringer, who is present in that foreign country, to come forward with a description of the law, right? The patentee better be able to show that there's not a conflict. The accused infringer, who is at least involved in some aspects in that country, will have good information about, well, why should the patent system be different? So to me, you've got the adversarial system working to put that information forward. And then finally, there are other sources of information about the state of U.S. patent law. Patent law is a huge source of debate with respect to international trade. And so the U.S. government, the U.S. trade representative, they do these special 301 reports that explain whose country's laws are problematic. And so I think there are plenty of sources of information about it. Do I think it makes patent litigation more complicated? Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I also think that if you're wanting this rather exceptional remedy of using a nationally based patent to control foreign activity, then you should step up to the plate and take on that burden and prove to the court that you're not going to create this problem.
Does it?
To that extent, you're giving patentees some greater rights than they had before. I think that they would view that a little bit more favorably. So I do think it would be workable. Easy? No. Not at all. You're going to have to dive into foreign patent law, find out what the differences are. Some differences may be easy, right? A certain country doesn't give patent protection for software. Well, then we're not going to let you use your U.S. patent to enforce it in that country. Mm-hmm. Others might be a little, or there's a different owner of the patent in a different country, right? That one would be pretty easy. We don't want you to basically be able to interfere with a different others might be more subtle, and I admit to that. So I think it, but I do believe it's absolutely feasible.
Does, before we move into a broader question regarding the patent system in the U.S. And how it works, does your solution, in your view, smooth over some of the political ramifications of having to go into a foreign court and say, look at my U.S. patent, you should enforce it here? In other words, by creating a system that is more sensitive to territorial boundaries and to the right of an individual country to create laws that sees fit. Does your solution, or how do you think your proposed solution deals with those kinds of issues? And they do come up, as you know, as a litigator, they come up when you attempt to enforce, we see this when if you attempt to enforce a U.S. judgment in a foreign court or vice versa, that there's a certain amount of reticence initially from courts to even consider the particular order to be valid. It seems like your solution does address that issue.
I mean, I think it would help it. I don't know that it would answer all those types of issues, but I think it would show that the U.S. courts are being more sensitive to the laws of foreign countries, which I don't think our court system does that very well now. I think other court systems do take into account foreign law. You look at Canada and their decision not to grant patent protection on the Onco mouse, this mouse that was genetically engineered to get cancer. It's under patent protection in the United States. Canada, they decided, look, we're not going to grant patents to cover higher-order living beings. But throughout the decision, there's this juxtaposition with U.S. patent law. Right, they're willing to look at U.S. patent law, other patent law from other jurisdictions to inform their own country's analysis. You don't see that in the United States nearly as much. And I think if with my approach, you would show that, hey, look, we realize that this is there's a world out there, and we need to take that into account. So I do think it would add persuasive force in trying to get enforcement of judgments in other jurisdictions as well. The other thing about my approach, and I meant to mention this, is that my approach also does give protection for the circumstances where you've got two countries at play, right? So with the BlackBerry case, you've got both Canada and the United States with these trans-border systems. If you go with the strict approach, right, it could very well be that you can't enforce that patent anywhere, right? Even in Canada, if they took the same approach, sorry, part of it's in the United States, you get no protection at all. So at least with this approach, even if there's a workability issue, I'm expanding the scope of patent protection to accommodate that circumstance as well, which the other systems don't deal with quite as well.
To transition a bit into the broader issues, again, that have gotten some attention and that we discuss on Hearsay Culture regarding the operations of the U.S. patent system itself, I guess I'll ask this question, which is you've discussed the fact that there is a certain amount of harmonization across the globe with regard to patent law. Why not propose some kind of international patent system that would obviate the need to have much of the litigation that you've described and that you acknowledge would still exist with respect to these issues? Is there a way to do that?
And basically, you could say that we just need a global patent, mm-hmm. right? We should just have you can get a patent that gives you patent rights around the world, maybe not quite the same as the copyright system, because we still want review of your application to make sure you actually created an invention worthy of protection, but why not just have a global patent? And there are a lot of people who think that should be the case. The reality is that even though we have this sort of higher level harmonization, there's lots of disagreement about more of the particulars of patent law. And I can guarantee you the United States is not going to step back and say, fine, we're going to give up control of our patent system and abdicate our sovereignty to some international agency that's going to coordinate patents. So I think you're right. You know, if you get a global patent, that would obviate these problems. The political reality is there's a lot of social policy, innovation policy, and trade policy that's wrapped up in patents. To get national governments to give that up would be quite a big challenge. Mm-hmm. You can see this dynamic in the tension between the World Trade Organization and the World Intellectual Property Organization. The developing world likes to channel things through the WTO because it tends to be more protective of the developed world. Whereas WIPO, you have a very much more influence from the developing world, who oftentimes want weaker patent protection because they view patents as inhibiting their ability to develop economically.
Mm-hmm.
So to try and get all of those interests to coalesce and to create a global patent at this time just seems absolutely impossible. What we have agreed to do and what we do have is a system that streamlines the acquisition of national patents. You can file through WIPO an international patent application that then devolves into a host of national patents. So we've streamlined the patent acquisition process, but the enforcement side is still caught up in these various policy debates and choices about what about innovation policy within a given country.
The kind of almost the flip side to some degree of having an international patent system has been explored by previous guests on the show as well as future guests. So as you know, Mike Moore and Jim Besson have written a book recently called Patent Failure, where they explore from an empirical perspective various problems that exist with respect to how the patent system works and what patents are issued and so forth. Later on in the year, I'm going to have professors David Levine, no relation, although there are David Levines everywhere, as I've noted on my blog, but Professors David Levine and Michael Boldrin, who are coming out with a book basically arguing that the patent system itself should basically be eliminated. So I guess I'll ask you the flip side question, which is, do you think the patent system is broken? And if so, how? And what do you think of these, what do you think of the solution of saying no patents at all?
Well, I'll answer the last question first. I think no patents at all would be a huge mistake. I think that patents have been an important driver for innovation, not only within the United States, but around the world. I'm a strong advocate of patent rights. So I think if you eliminate patent rights, you eliminate not only the incentive to create, but the ability to get venture capital money to develop an invention. I think that to throw the baby out with the bathwater would be a really bad idea in this case. That being said, with the Patent Failure book, do I think the patent system is broken? My answer today is different than it would have been about 5 years ago. 5 years ago, I would have said yes. The patent system is broken. I don't think that it's necessarily failed completely, but I think that patent rights were too strong in terms of what you get with your patent, that you automatically could get a permanent injunction, which would shut down your competitor. I think there were lots of patents that should not have been issued. I think the trivial improvements over the state of the art were being patented, creating lots of patent rights that were just used to annoy competitors. The reason I say 5 years ago I would have agreed is that the Supreme Court in particular has stepped in the last few years. And, you know, there have been patent reform proposals in Congress. If you look at what the drivers were for patent reform, this report by the Federal Trade Commission and by the National Research Council, a lot of the concerns that they addressed have been remedied by the courts. And even the patent reform that has been legislatively proposed, a lot of the things that have gone, that were proposed, have been changed by the courts. So the thing about Mike's book, the Patent Failure book, is I'm sort of in a wait-and-see period, in that I think that the courts have addressed the concerns that I have had, and I want, before we keep tweaking the system more, I want to see how things settle out. Because my fear is, were patents too strong, overly protective, were there too many patents 5 years ago? Yes. But I don't want to see the patent, this pendulum swing so far where patents become, in essence, worthless, and they don't have much value, and they're not, you know, there's no reason to get patents anymore. I don't want to see the pendulum swing too far to the left. I think we've gotten to a point where we're right about in the middle, and before we tweak, I think we should give ourselves some time to assess. And so it'll be interesting to see what takes place. But I think the courts have done a pretty good job of remedying at least what, in my eyes, were the primary glaring flaws in the system.
The I understand your view with respect to waiting and seeing. However, I think that those that are more presently concerned about the system might say, well, the longer we wait, the more innovation might be crushed by patents that should have never issued in the first place. And that leads to the hot button issue that we mentioned earlier and that we can discuss now in the last 7 or 8 minutes or so of the show, which is software and business method patents. So what do you make of that potential concern that by waiting to see what's going to happen, we could quell or at least stifle innovation that might otherwise occur because of the issuance of patents that shouldn't be issued? And what's your view of whether software or business method patents should be patentable subject matter?
Well, I kind of divide those up. I'm not as opposed to software patents because I really think that innovative things happen in software that, technically speaking, there's some that is more akin to what you think of as innovation. Business methods, accounting methods, those sorts of things, is that a tough line to draw? Yes, but I put those in a different camp, you know, tax evasion methods. To me, those aren't the things that the patent system is typically about. I don't know that there's been any proof that we really need the patent incentive to create innovation there. And I also think, well, those may be struck down soon by the courts anyway, so that's part of the wait and see, is some of these issues are still percolating. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, you know, one of the benefits, if you want to call it that, to the courts acting is that these things can be retroactive. Right, if the courts come out and say, look, patents on business methods are not eligible for patent protection, then existing patents go away. Poof, gone, right? They're simply saying this is how the state of the law could be. If Congress does that, it's trickier, right? Typically, it's only going to be prospective, and so existing patents would be allowed to stay in force. If they do make it retroactive, then you have the potential for a claim for takings, that the Congress has changed the law and they've eviscerated this right, and they can't do that without affording compensation to those people that currently have the property rights. So I think there's that added advantage to the court, letting the court system percolate on things and keeping it away from Congress, and that I think the courts, if you think those are bad patents, which I do think, I don't like them, I don't, there's reasons in terms of, do we need them for innovation? I think there's notice problems. You know, how many accountants really thought they had to worry about patent rights? Mm-hmm. So there's a notice problem. But if the courts say, look, those patents should not have issued, then they all go away. Mm-hmm. Congress really can't do that, at least not as cleanly.
Tim, we have about 5 minutes left, and of course that's woefully inadequate time to start a new topic, but we've touched on it a little bit, and so I do want to kind of close the ring by mentioning your scholarship in the patenting of human genes. And again, it falls under the lines broadly of patentable subject matter, but for listeners who aren't familiar, what's the status of that issue?
Genes are patentable. I mean, I think that battle has been lost. The ship has sailed, and it's on to new waters. If you purify and identify a sequence, a genetic sequence that codes for a protein or that codes for a disease, right, like breast cancer, you can get patent protection for it. Now, do I like that? No. Mm-hmm. I don't think that should have been the case, but I view that as kind of a battle that's fairly been lost. The next issues will be then, well, what about the patenting of some of these, you know, the proteins and proteomics? There's certain aspects of gene patenting, like we saw in the laboratory case that the Supreme Court decided not to decide, where it was, you know, a correlation between a certain protein level and having a vitamin deficiency. You know, that seems just be a product of nature. And some gene patents work like that, right? If you have this single point mutation that predisposes you to cancer, that just seems to be a natural law, you know, a natural correlation. So I still think there may be some room within the field of gene patents that some of these may be invalidated as simply being a law of nature. But overall, you know, I think that gene patents are here to stay.
It's kind of interesting, I think, especially for those thinking about these issues, to to note the contrast that we're debating whether genes should be patented, and ultimately the courts have concluded that they are, and yet there's a hotter debate about whether software should be patented.
Right.
It kind of makes you wonder what's left of any limitations on patentable subject matter, and I think those that have a dimmer view perhaps of the patent system than you do currently would say there are no limits, and that's one of the big debates going on, as you know. Tim, in our remaining few minutes, I know that you're a very active scholar, and you have a book coming out, and perhaps you could mention briefly what that is, and for those that want to learn more about what you do, where can they go?
Well, you can always check out the webpage for Chicago Kent. It's www.kentlaw.edu. And you're right, I'm writing, along with Meredith Addy here in Chicago, a two-volume treatise on patent law. It's meant to be a little bit more than an introduction to patent law, but not horribly, you know, inaccessible. And we're planning on taking a little bit more of an international perspective. It's still U.S. patent law, but we want to give it a little more international flavor. That is being published by Oxford University Press, set to be completed in the summer of 2009. Fingers crossed, and the minute I get off this phone, I need to get back to the keyboard to get back to work on it. But that should be out sometime mid to late 2009.
Well, we've been chatting with Tim Holbrook, a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law. Tim, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Certainly, I invite you back to continue discussing these topics, but thank you for taking the time today to chat with my listeners.
Thank you. It's been a wonderful time. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So we will be continuing discussions, as I mentioned, towards the end of the show here with a number of guests, several of whom are going to be focusing on issues regarding patents. As I mentioned, Professors David Levine and Michelle Boldrin from Washington University in St. Louis have a book coming out where they're going to ultimately suggest that the patent system should be blown up, the legal phrase blown up, of course, but destroyed. So I'm looking forward to chatting with Professors Levine and Boldrin. As well, a number of guests are going to be on discussing other issues in intellectual property. Among them will be Ned Snow from University of Arkansas Little Rock, who's written on copyright and the Internet, as well as Paul Ohm from University of Colorado Boulder, who's written fascinating articles regarding computers and the law, as well as Neil Netinel from USC, who has a book out called A Copyright Paradox, or Copyright's Paradox, looking at the copyright system. Other guests are going to be discussing more directly focused on technology issues, among them Michelle Bowens from the Peer-to-Peer Foundation, Clay Shirky, author of Here Comes Everybody, Michelle Morell Hildebrand, who's written a book on, along with several co-authors, on privacy laws in the EU, David Rice, author of Geekonomics, Hal Abelson, and Ken Ledeen, authors of the book Blown to Bits, along with Harry Lewis, looking at literally the subtitle is Your Life, Liberty, and Happiness in the Digital Explosion, an interesting area. The polar opposite of many of the guests in terms of topics and viewpoint will be Professor Mark Barrowline, who's written a book called The Dumbest Generation, taking a much dimmer view of technology than many of the guests that I've had on, as well as Andrew Luman and Wendy Seltzer, who are going to be on discussing the Tor Project, a very interesting ongoing project involving privacy and anonymity in electronic communications, and a somewhat controversial organization as well, and we're going to be exploring some of those issues. Michael Gollin, who's a partner at Venable LLP, who's written a book called Driving Innovation, looking at how businesses can use intellectual property rights to their advantage. And other guests, Nick Carr, in January of 2009, we'll be having a new edition of his more recent book out, and we'll be talking to him as well. So I continue to book and schedule new guests for Hearsay Culture. Primarily, it will be for the winter quarter at this point, so I'm booking guests, or new guests anyway, for the end of the year and into early next year. As always, I welcome your suggestions and input and any comments on the shows by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. And as always, there are many ways that you can listen to this show. The first and primary way is to go live to KZSU FM Stanford. You can stream the show by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu, or if you're in the Bay Area, listening on 90.1 FM. Also, you can get the show through iTunes, through the Center for Internet Society's webpage. You can also get the show through hearsayculture.com. Many of you get the show there, or through the Center for Internet Society's homepage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture today. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I will talk to you next week.